Good afternoon, Juno. Welcome to a Juno Afternoon. And this show is a collaboration today of the Black Awareness Association of Juno and KTOO. We have two very special guests today that we are honored to speak with. These are two very accomplished music professionals, Lori Grace, who is a music teacher and the founder of Lori Grace Music and Future Stars, and Charles E. Dickerson III, who is the founder, executive director, and conductor of the Inner City Youth Orchestra of Los Angeles. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. It's a joy to be here.
Absolutely. So just a little bit about how this show came about for our listeners. A few weeks ago, we had the pleasure of interviewing a librarian who joined us via Zoom from Orlando. And it was a show that we did on Black literature, the history of Black literature and Black authors, especially in our school system. And we got a really good response from the community about it. And we all learned so much. I know that I did. And so that kind of got our wheels turning. And we thought, why don't we do a segment also on music and particularly Black music? And then that subject kind of unfolded. And then I was introduced to Mr. Dickerson, who is an African-American conductor, and I've never met one before, and that just opened up a whole new world of questions, and so we're in for a really special treat today. We're going to learn a lot, and I'm very, very excited to do this. So I'm just going to ask our guests to introduce themselves. Miss Lori, would you mind introducing yourself, please?
Hi, I'm Lori Grace, and I've been teaching for over 26 years in Long Beach Unified School District. I'm a recent retiree of 1 year. And I started doing this work by wanting to change how music was being infused for the 21st century learner, not just teaching choral music, but I wanted to begin to implement music and social movements, music and social justice, and how music influenced and changed politics and changed lives. And so, and I also teach privately, and that's what Future Stars is for. And we provide scholarships for young people for their first year of college.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. And I know Miss Lori personally. I'm one of her former piano students, and I took some vocal coaching with her as well. And she just quickly became more than my teacher. She's also my friend, my mentor. I look up to her very much, and I am just so ecstatic to have you here today, Miss Lori.
It's nice to be here. Thank you so much.
And Mr. Dickerson.
Well, thank you so much. Good day, Christina, and good day to everybody who's listening. Thank you so much for being with us today. I have the joy and pleasure of being a conductor, and that means that I'm a person who stands in front of musical ensembles and hopefully helps people learn music and then perform music in usually pretty grand settings, usually in a concert setting. I've been doing this for about 45 years. I am 68 years old, and I conducted my first orchestra with a chorus when I was 21 years old. I did a presentation of Handel's Messiah, and I've been doing this kind of work ever since then. Right now, I primarily focus on teaching younger people. I am the director, the conductor of the Inner City Youth Orchestra of Los Angeles and the Southside Chicago Youth Orchestra. And these are both, as is said in the name of both of those organizations, youth orchestras. And the core of the people that I have the privilege of working with are middle school and high school age, although many of the young people who join our orchestra come back even after they finish college and play with us because, frankly, they have no other place to play. So I have the privilege of working with a variety of folks from middle school age, generally through about at least through the 20s.
Wonderful. Excellent. Thank you so much. And we have a lot of questions about the orchestra and the population that you work with that we're going to get into a little bit later. I can't wait for that.
Good. Looking forward to it.
Okay, so I'm going to just ask some questions here about kind of around what's happening with the in our in our country and really around the world with the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, all of the racial issues and tension that we've been experiencing for the past few months. And I'm just wondering how music plays a role in all of that, because I know that it does and I know that it always has. But just more specifically, I guess I'm wondering how. And so my question is, Black music has always been very bold in expressing what was happening with our people. And we've never had any issues celebrating ourselves in our music. We labored hard all week, and only our artists could say things that we could relate to about the conditions of our communities. So I am wondering, what are some of your favorite songs written during or about the good times?
Oh, well, that's very easy. You know, I thank my grandfather for always wanting to give me his historical account of music and keep me abreast on what he was listening to as a young man growing up. But Let the Good Times Roll,
yes,
was a favorite, you know, at Louis Jordan. And it was remade by Ray Charles. And I think Quincy Jones even put it on Juke Joint, just to bring that into the 20th century. But, you know, we have music that brings us together, songs like Family Reunion by the OJs. You know, whenever families are getting together, that song is played for Black family reunions, and Before I Let Go by Frankie Beverly and Maze. You know, that is a song that unites us. I don't care what generation you are. You know, we even pulled our babies on the floor for that song. They've been birthed with this song. And so thank goodness for Beyonce, who, when she did Homecoming, she remade Before I Let Go and introduced this to the millennials, for those who never heard it, and a different audience. For all of her attendees there at Coachella that year. And so, you know, we also have music like the line dances, the cha-cha slide and the Cupid shuffle and the wobble that bring us together and unite us to have a good time and to express ourselves on the floor. And that this music has brought young and old together, and I think that it's a lot of it is timeless, and it will be around for a long time for us to celebrate ourselves.
Wow, absolutely. What a great answer. And all of those songs, like as you were listing them, I'm hearing them in my head, and it just makes me want to dance now. So yeah. That is absolutely
true. Can I add in a couple of years, please?
Of course, yes.
So, you know, Lori has pointed out some great, great contemporary music, but I want to go back to some of the old spirituals that choral music that choirs used to sing, particularly our people. And I want to specifically talk about three, because these were very important songs during, particularly right at the end of slavery, like Oh Freedom, Oh Freedom, Freedom Over Me. Before I be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we're free at last. Dr. King referred to that song in his 1963 I Have a Dream speech. And another great one from those days, Great Day, the Righteous Marching. 1863, Day of Jubilee, God's going to set his people free. These are songs of joy and songs of celebration and exuberance about the relief from the conditions that African Americans had suffered since 1619, since we first arrived on these shores.
Yes. Excellent. Thank you so much. And I'm making a note of these things. And to our listeners, we will have a just a list of some of the songs and what we talked about today on our Facebook page, and we'll share that at the end of the show. Excellent. So just like we sang about having a good time and our good thing, we sang about the injustices, being oppressed, underpaid, segregated, etc. Who are the most influential artists who clearly told of our struggles? What songs did they write? And what are the stories behind them?
You know, I think that we have, you know, some unsung heroes and some people that we just don't know about. We call them Negro spirituals now, but there were people singing in the fields while they were picking cotton and tobacco, you know, the calls, cries, and hollers that we have, you know, singing songs like Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen. There were hidden messages that we were singing as slaves, you know. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, you know. Mm. And so we don't know the author or who wrote some of those songs, but they were sung, and they're still widely known. We call them Negro spirituals now, but if I can fast forward to the 1920s, that we were always celebrating music through jazz down there in New Orleans, and we celebrated life with jazz as well as in death. When you hear the song "Oh, When the Saints," I mean that you can be walking in New Orleans right now in the middle of the street, and that "Oh, When the Saints," you know, just That's makes right. you want to just bop around and just, you know, dance around, because just the way that's played. And Sam Cooke in the 1960s was very, very influential in, he was a gospel singer who had bought a record company and had become a singer for rhythm and blues, and he made A Change Is Gonna Come in the 1960s. And unfortunately, he didn't live to see that song released, but mm-hmm. it still has a powerful impact today, A Change Is Gonna Come, because he wanted to see something different for his people. And if I can just kind of chime in about Marvin Gaye in 1971, when he wrote the anthology, What's Going On, that's over 40 years ago. And that song is still very popular today. You know, What's Going On, the things that he was talking about, the inner city blues, you know, the ecology. He was talking about what some of us are experiencing with climate change. And Stevie Wonder was bold with his voice by making Living for the City,
yes.
you know, and making Happy Birthday to make Dr. King's birthday a legal holiday. All of the proceeds went to that. So, you know, we've had music that have brought us over, that, you know, have had a message. When rap came along in the 1980s, you know, we were seeing the song The Message from the brothers in New York, the things that were happening. They were saying, don't push me because I'm close to the edge.
Yes.
I'm trying not to lose my head, you know, and fight the power from Public Enemy. And the song's going on, and we have some of our modern day poets, you know, Tupac talked about, you know, let's not call our women, you know, the B word, but, yeah. you know, because we come from a mother, and you know, we have to respect that. And so, you know, so many different artists, not just rappers, but, you know, and R&B artists have sang about, you know, what we've gone through as a people. And I think that Kendrick Lamar and a lot of these young rappers today have a new twist on what we hear that's going on in our community, Black Lives Matter. I think I heard the song Her saying, I can't breathe because of George Floyd. So there's more creativity coming forward as we see more of our evolution, you know, in our times today.
Absolutely. I'd like to lift up two songs to you that probably are not well known. One of them is by a composer by the name of T.J. Smith. And this song that he wrote was before 2009. And the name of the song was There'll Be Chitlins in the White House One Day.
Oh, wow.
And I think you know the message. I don't need to say, well, maybe your listeners don't quite understand the implication of that. But the implication is that one day there's going to be a black president. So
Absolutely.
This was before Mr. Obama was elected. But then I'd also like to share with you, Christina, that I do a little composing myself. And a song that I wrote in 2017 in tribute to Colin Kaepernick, This Is Why We Kneel.
Yes.
This is a song that lifts up why the NFL players were kneeling at that time. Of course, that's become a little bit more accepted in today's world. You see NBA players and the WNBA particularly, both the NBA and the WNBA have the words Black Lives Matter written on the floor of the NBA and WNBA finals. But all of that came about because I think of what Mr. Kaepernick did in terms of kneeling. So I wrote a song in tribute to him, and I hope everybody will go online and find it. You can find it on YouTube or Vimeo. This Is Why We Kneel, and it tells the story why we're kneeling.
Good. Excellent. And that'll be something that we'll also post a link to on the BAA Facebook page as part of the
Thank
resources.
You.
Absolutely. Ms. Lori, just to touch a little bit on what you said with the song, particularly the message, I grew up in the 80s and the 90s, and my parents were very, very strict Baptist ministers. And so we didn't listen to anything that was not a hymn, that was not praise and worship music. Like, I could not wait until I turned 16. I actually had friends making me mix tapes and stuff to play in my car where I could listen to anything I wanted to. And then that's kind of when I broke free and got to listen to all the music. I caught up on all the music in the world. But I really didn't grow up listening to a lot of the classics and oldies. And just recently, as you know, I was just preparing for this interview, I was listening to The Message. This is kind of embarrassing, but the first time I heard that was, I think, with Puff Daddy, and maybe it was Puff Daddy and Mace. And I had no idea that they sampled The Message from like the 70s or the, when did that come out? The 70s?
Yes, it came out in the 70s.
Yeah. And so the first 70. Time I heard it was sometime in 2000 something, or maybe the late 90s. And I'm thinking this is, you know, new hot music. And it was actually sampled from, you know, 20, 30 years prior. And what they were talking about with, like you said, don't push me because I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head because of all of the things that were happening. They were talking about the racial injustice and the oppression in that song. And it was kind of like the first, I kind of see it as the first rap song to really push that message. I could be wrong, but that's, you know.
You're right.
Okay.
It was, because there were a lot of things that were going on in New York at that time. There was a lot of deprived neighborhoods, and their neighborhoods had just went to nothing. And but yet and still people were going to Studio 54 and dancing disco and dressing up. So this is why hip hop really came about, because they were in their own neighborhoods. Listen, guys would come and take their speakers and pull them outside and plug up to a telephone pole to get some electricity so that the neighborhood could have the same type of feeling good and dancing. You know, disco was very popular back in the early 70s, and there was a discotheque that was very popular, Studio 54, that anyone would attend Studio 54. And so these young guys would have an MC, there would be someone DJing, and then there would be an MC talking over the music. So This is how we get hip hop. And it was for them to talk about what was going on. They didn't have the fancy clothes that could get them into Studio 54. They just wore what they wore, but it became a fashion statement, you know, Kangol hats and snapback hats and you know, the clothing that we now saw as hip hop, or we see as hip hop wear.
Yes.
Zoot suits.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, this is becoming has become a hot topic in the past few months, where we're raising the conversation about racism and equality and justice. And it's always been an issue, but just especially since the death of Mr. George Floyd, it's resurging. And so now we're kind of taking a look at where racism exists just across the board. And so my question is, do you believe that racism exists even in the music industry? And if so, in what ways?
Well, absolutely. I think we have a young man, Lil Nas X, who very clearly, when he made the Old Town Road, it was not in the category of rhythm and blues. The Old Town Road was a Western song. It was a country song. And the country artist community and country music listeners did not want to accept that young man because of the color of his skin. And it took the artist Billy Ray Cyrus to come along and to help push this song, because it was a country song. I mean, we've seen a few African-American country artists in country music, you know, Charlie Pride, you know, there was one or two. And our music, you know, we're from the South. Our music had country influence. The banjo comes from Africa. And so, you know, we have, Lil Nas X, getting back to him, he had to try to get some help to push that song, Old Town Road, which won 3 Grammys, by the way, this last year. So not only was that song received by African Americans, but it was a colorless song. It was a song that reached different radio stations, and it was played, sold millions of copies. And it's a song that my granddaughter loves to listen to. Whenever she's in the car, she goes, "Put on my song, Old Town Road." And you know, it's a fun song to just move around to, but it was with the category, because of the Grammys, there are different categories of music, and it was a country song, and he won. It was a contemporary country song, so I'm glad to see more African Americans moving into the area of country music, but I still think that we still have some barriers that we're trying to break down. I mean, look at how Cardi B has influence rap music,
yeah,
with her Latin feel, you mm-hmm. know. So, you know, some of these things are being taken down and, you know, dismantled.
Christina, I believe that you were asking about racism in the music industry. You know, everybody knows the name Motown, but very few people understand that, or Stax Records. Very few people know that Motown primarily became what it became. It became the one place where African Americans could go and record, because in years past we were not encouraged or not permitted in many studios to actually go in and record. And Berry Gordy saw this problem, and he tried to alleviate it, and in fact did a great job at doing so by creating a place where black artists could go in and actually record. And of course then after all these great hits of the 50s came out, and Motown got its label that it did, I think Motown also had a great influence in helping black artists cross over. And by crossover, I don't mean just crossover in terms of genres of music, but actually have white people enjoy the music that was produced by black people. And this helped to break down, even that kind of thing, helped to break down racism within America. For white people to be able to dance to the music of somebody black, finally allow a black person to come into a club where only white people were allowed to be the entertainers. Mm-hmm. Well, we finally got the opportunity to go in and become the entertainers. Finally, at some point, we even got to go in and be some of the patrons of some of those institutions. But racism still heavily, particularly impacts the classical world, which is a world that I know quite intimately. I happen to serve on the board of the League of American Orchestras. I am one of five African Americans on a board of 60 that oversees essentially the orchestra world in the United States. Mm. And I can give you some pretty up-to-date statistics. Regrettably, while African Americans comprise 13% of the American population, we only comprise 1.8% of the workforce of American orchestras.
Wow.
While Latinos make up 13% of the U.S. population, they comprise only 2.5% of the workforce in American orchestras. There are efforts that are currently being undertaken to try to improve those statistics, and my organization, the Inner City Youth Orchestra of Los Angeles, actually is engaged and involved in one of those projects. We have learned that one of the reasons why the statistics are so low with respect to African Americans and Latinos being part of the orchestral world is that we oftentimes do not win the auditions. Now, there were in order to get into an orchestra, you have to win an audition. Mm-hmm. Just like if you're going to be a part of a baseball club or something, you got to pass the tryout. Well, in the classical music world, particularly in the instrumental music world, there are auditions, and we were not doing well on the auditions. A lot of us felt as though, well, part of the reason is because the minute they see us walk out on stage to take the audition, they don't want us.
Right.
So the industry adopted a process. They started putting a screen down, a screen that you couldn't see through. So African Americans, and this impacted women too, by the way. When a woman would come out to take an audition, a lot of the old white men, didn't want women to be part of the orchestra. So the minute a woman walked out, they'd say, "Oh, very nice. Thank you for your audition." That would be the end of it. Mm. So they put a screen down. And what happened is that women did quite well once the screen went down. African Americans and Latinos still have not done as well. And now there are special programs around the country, here and there, and our orchestra conducts one of these programs to actually assist young people who are aspiring for a career in an orchestra to take and win auditions in American orchestras. So it's regrettable to say, but racism is still quite rampant in the music industry. I particularly see it in the classical music industry. One more thing I want to say about this. I find it I'll use the word ironic. I could use other words, but ironic might be the kindest word I can use.
Okay.
To find that so many organizations, particularly white-run organizations, now that George Floyd has died and everybody has seen actually what happens in the African-American community every day, now a lot of these white organizations are flocking to us to say, okay, how can we have our black people? How can we have our black moment? Can we have a relationship with you? Can you be our black face?
Yeah.
And all too often, regrettably, that effort is not sincere. It's just that people, particularly I found in the nonprofit world, want to be able to say, hey, look at our diversity work.
Right.
We're doing a great job with diversity, so therefore, fund us. But I hope that more and more entities will take this work seriously, and hopefully we all will realize that not just in the music industry, but throughout our country, there are people of all colors, of all genders, of all gender IDs, who are valuable people and who can actually contribute to the bottom line, the bottom economic line of every single business, every single industry, and particularly since Lori and I are in the music industry, we certainly hope that that will be the case with the music industry.
Wow.
Forgive me, that was a long answer, but there's so much to say about this point. Yeah.
Thank you so much. We're just learning so much here today and having a lot to think about. We're just going to take one moment here and pause for a commercial break. And when we come back, we will continue this conversation. We'll be right back. Good afternoon, Juno, and we are back from our commercial break. I am your host for today's show, Christina Michelle, a member of the Black Awareness Association of Juno. And today's Juno Afternoon is a collaboration of Black Awareness Association of Juno and KTOO. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with two guests who are here with us via Zoom from Los Angeles, California, Miss Lori Grace, who is a music teacher and the founder of Lori Grace Music and Future Stars, and Mr. Charles E. Dickerson III, who's the founder, executive director, and conductor of the Inner City Youth Orchestra of Los Angeles. For the first part of the show, we've just been discussing African Americans in music, and we're just going to jump back into that conversation. One question that I would like to ask is earlier in the segment, I had said that I had just learned about the message and how it was actually sampled, how their song was sampled later on by, I think it was Puff Daddy and Mace or one or both of them. And I'm wondering, are there other songs that we, maybe the younger generation, have heard and that they were recorded by white artists that actually originated with African-American artists? I hope that question makes sense.
Oh, yeah.
That was a mouthful. And in particular, just as I was preparing for the interview today, I learned that the hook to Bad to the Bone by George Thorogood, that that was the first time I heard it, Bad to the Bone, you know, and I learned that it was actually sampled from Manish Boy by Muddy Waters, and that came out in 1954. So,
from the beginning of time, I mean, you know, Pat Boone made a lot of money off of us, Elvis Presley, you know, there's a number of artists, but, you know, one man in particular, Solomon Linda, in 1939, this song has been recorded and redone and covered by several white artists, and they are just now, his family is just now getting their due in court with Disney, because the song The Lion Sleeps Tonight, Solomon Linda, 1939, made this song, and so many white artists. Pete Seeger, I mean, you name it. Several white artists have covered this song. If you go to YouTube now, I just looked down at YouTube. The first hit on there for The Lion Sleeps Tonight is a group called The Tokens. And this song was created in 1939. The Beach Boys had great success with this song. And this man's family did not see a dime. But when it went to Lion King, Disney had, there is a feature film about it on Netflix that talks about this. But anyway, our music has always been sampled. You know, some people may think about Twist and Shout and say, well, the Beatles recorded Twist and Shout, but it was originally written and recorded by the Isley Brothers.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. Wow.
Yes, it's an Isley Brothers original. And he says it every time he does a show. You know, you make me want to shout. All of that. Throw your hands up and shout. Yes. You know, we hear these songs at games. And our music has always been borrowed. I think that it still is. Several cases recently of the Marvin Gaye family. Going after Sheeran, going after Robin Thicke. So, you know... Bruno Mars has even gotten in a little bit of trouble with the Gap Band. So, you know, music has been borrowed, if we will, for a long time. And I doubt if we, we'll keep seeing it. You know, I think if somebody thinks that they can get away with it, they're going to go ahead and certainly try.
Interesting. I love the word borrowed. Love it.
I'd like to add one little thing here real quickly.
Yes, sir.
Anton Dvorak in the classical world was a composer who was born in Czechoslovakia, but who came to the United States in his 20s. And it might not have been in his 20s, but he came to the United States, went to New York, and picked up with a fellow by the name of H.T. Burley. And Mr. Burley was a black man who was a great singer and a great composer. One of the symphonies that Dvorak wrote is called the Symphony from the New World. It's the ninth symphony of Anton Dvorak. The second movement of that particular piece is a Negro spiritual. H.T. Burley used to sing the spirituals to Dvorak. One of them is the spiritual Going Home. Going home, going home. I am going home. It's really sung around about funerals and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Dvorak took that very melody and made it into the second movement of the New World Symphony. So, you know, folks have been taking music from black composers and black people and the black experience throughout history.
Yeah.
And been regrettable. I guess it's a good thing that they're blowing our music up, but it's regrettable that we have not enjoyed the financial benefit of a lot of these kinds of borrowings.
Yes, yeah. We'll just clear our throats on that and toss our hair. All right. If you are just joining us today, we are here having a discussion about the history of Black music in the United States and around the world. We're here with Miss Lori Grace from Los Angeles, California, and Mr. Charles E. Dickerson, also from Los Angeles, California. I'm wondering, what would you like to see more of in the music industry, especially pertaining to opportunities for Blacks?
You know, I'd like to see the music industry invest back in our schools with our children, invest instruments, invest music equipment, because, you know, we have a lot of talented kids who, you know, we grow up from the womb, you know, interested in music. You know, a lot of us sing church choirs as children. There's instruments at church, but there are a lot of times instruments are not at home.
Yeah.
And our school system has somewhat kicked music out because, you know, of funding. And so if our music industry would take the opportunity to reinvest in our children, even with some of the electronic equipment where kids are like, they like to make, they say, the beat, you know, software and computers where these kids can create to do this. I think that it would do a great service to our young people. And I would love to see the industry reinvest in inner city schools across the country, because our kids are so dynamic and they love music so much. And to have this early start, it takes about 20 years, you know, to really saturate yourself and yes. become great if you're a musician, if you're going to be a guitarist. And by the time the kid gets an instrument in their hand and let's just say they want to go to college, you know, like kids in Charles' orchestra, violins are hard to come by, or buy the strings that can, you know, to restring the violins or the cellos at these schools, and not let them just sit there because, you know, nobody is repairing them or putting them back to good use. Yes. That's what I would like to see.
Thank you so much for that. I'm wondering here, as we close out this part of the segment, if our listeners want to become more familiar with influential Black singers, writers, and musicians, Ms. Lori, where would you suggest that they start?
You know, it is often said that Ella Fitzgerald is our key to all of these contemporary singers, that there is a touch of Ella in every, you know, new singer. But go back and listen to the singers that have made the singers that we are today, you know, people like Ella Fitzgerald, Nancy Wilson, yes. you know, and then you have to move up the timeline and listen to, you know, people who were going to Dinah Washington and Natalie Cole, Patti Austin, and Chaka Khan and Aretha Franklin. You got to go back and get this, because this is a rich part of our history, because these ladies, you know, were part of growing up listening to music that came out of the 40s, listening to Ella, and our singers today, people like Alicia Keys, her, Lauryn Hill, you know, there's a touch, Ledisi. If you listen to Ledisi, boy, you listen to a young Chaka Khan again. And so you have to go back, because you're getting parts of it today anyway. And I cannot forget Nina Simone. I mean, my goodness.
Yes.
We're singing a lot of her standards. And Nina was an entity all of her own, you know, being a pianist, a classically trained pianist, and what she had to do to become, you know, to get work, and how she said what she wanted to say in her music, singing and playing. And so we people like Michael Bublé who was covering, you know, Feeling Good, you know, people who are, you know, singing songs of Nina Simone. So they can take a listen back at some of those good singers like that. Sure.
Excellent. Thank you. And thank you for mentioning Nina Simone. She is one who I have been listening to more and more lately. And actually her song, I don't know if I can say this on the radio. If not, then we'll bleep it out. But Mississippi. I never heard that song until recently. And
yeah.
And really, it just, I liken it to kind of the NWA's F the Police, but of the 60s kind of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, she said Alabama got me so upset.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, and that was after the bombing of the young girls in the church.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and Childish Gambino made a song about, you know, the killing of what happened in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is America.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, we are still writing music about what we see and what's happening to our people. And I'm so glad that Nina Simone did that.
Yes.
And I'm glad that Childish Gambino said, this is America.
Absolutely. You know?
And you have to see the images of what he does in the video to really understand what he means by this is America. But we can definitely still see it with things like what's happening with, you know, with the death of George Floyd and mm-hmm. Ahmaud Arbery and the list goes on, Trayvon Martin, and the list goes on and the list goes on.
Excellent. Thank you. What a wonderful answer. Thank you, Ms. Lori. Can you share what is coming up next for you? What projects you're working on? What are you excited about?
I am excited about this book that I'm working on. I also work with the Heritage Music Foundation. The founder of this organization is Margaret DeRoe, the songwriter, the gospel songwriter. And I've been putting a calendar together with my team. This will be our third year of gospel musicians that have made great contributions to gospel music. And I have been, because I'm a musician in my heart, I've been wanting to do a book on the gospel musicians who make it happen, because Sunday after Sunday, I think that they are the unsung heroes in their churches. And we listen to recordings, and without these musicians, you know, there is no service. There is no worship service. And so I'm calling this book The Musicians, because a lot of them create a lot of magic on these recordings, where, you know, there are licks that we try to recreate or redo. And so I'm doing a table book that talks about the musicians and the bass players, the organists, the piano players, the ones past, present, and the ones that are coming in the future. Because I think it's important that we know who's behind the music. You know, these choir directors have people. I love Ricky Dillard from Chicago, but he has a great team of musicians playing. So I plan to go across the United States and find all the musicians, because they create some magic and make this book. So that's on the horizon. It may take me a little while, but it's definitely already in the works.
Excellent. And our viewers can't see, but Miss Lori is just lit up like a light bulb talking about this. And it just lights me up too. How exciting. I am so excited for you. Wonderful.
Thank you.
How can our listeners connect with, support, and get more information about you and your organization?
Okay, Future Stars, you know, we do a fundraiser each year to send kids to college. And so we have a PayPal account, and it's Future Stars. If you go to PayPal, it's Future Stars, and we would appreciate any donation. My email address is gracenote07@yahoo.com. And, you know, webpage is under construction, but we are making some things happen for our young people to go to college. At least we're buying books, you know, and this year we were able to give away 3 scholarships to 3 deserving young people who went to two to a historical Black college, and one young lady who wanted to start going to school for dentistry. So very excited about what we're getting a chance to do in the lives of young people today.
Excellent. And is it okay if we post the YouTube link for Future Stars to our page, that video that showed the 3
Absolutely.
Students? Okay,
absolutely.
Excellent. We'll do that there too. Okay. Well, I know that Miss Lori has another engagement to run to. You have been incredibly generous with your time already. I appreciate it. So we're going to
thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. And we are going to continue the conversation when we come back with Mr. Charles E. Dickerson III. Thank you, Miss Lori.
Thank you so much. Love you both.
Love you too. Thank you so much for joining us today. It has been a pleasure as always, and we really do appreciate you tuning in. Next week, we are going to continue the conversation with Mr. Charles Dickerson, who is the founder and director and conductor of the Inner City Youth Orchestra of Los Angeles, which is the largest African-American youth orchestra in the United States. This is a pretty big deal because, as Mr. Dickerson will share next week, there's only approximately 1.5% of African-Americans working in the classical field as musicians in classical orchestras. And up until recently, I naively assumed that the percentage was so low because there just wasn't a large interest on the part of African Americans to be in the orchestra or to become established musicians in the classical arena. Mr. Dickerson has enlightened me, and he is going to enlighten all of us next week and share, basically debunk that myth and share the real reasons why the percentage is so low and some of the challenges that African Americans have been facing when it comes to joining the orchestra and getting auditions and getting parts. And he's also going to share what is being done to help overcome those obstacles. So it's going to be another wonderful conversation, very enlightening and informative. And so I hope you'll come back and join us again next week. I have been your host for today's show, Christina Michelle Patterson. And again, it's an honor to be here, and we appreciate you joining us. We'll talk to you next week. Take care.